Choose your issues.
Hi, I'm Greg Salmieri. Welcome to a special edition of Choose Your Issues, a joint edition with my favorite podcast, and I think one of the most important programs in the world today, the Yaron Bruck Show. Joining me, Yaron Bruck. Great to have you here on the 40 Acres.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Greg. Really appreciate it.
So the title of our show is Choose Your Issues, I mean the general title, and we named that after Ayn Rand's first essay in – oh, we have an echo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think you have to just mute the computer.
I'm running two of these, and they're both out of sync, and they both were unmuted, but now they're muted. Technical issues in the Yaron Bruck Show. What's new?
Yeah. We called this a beta for a while because we were having all kinds of technical issues. Hopefully people could hear us. People should say in the chat whether they can, by the way.
I think they can. That's why there was an echo.
Yeah, that's true. We could hear us.
We could hear it. Yeah.
So we've named this podcast series after Ayn Rand's first article in the Objectivist newsletter, Choose Your Issues, Figure Out What to Talk About and Why. And you're, I think, the person doing that work best today, giving kind of regular commentary on the trends in the culture, the news. And you've been doing it for from an Objectivist perspective, and you've been doing it and leading the effort to do that for so long as president of the Ayn Rand Institute. So I really wanted a chance to talk to you about your approach to filtering out of everything what's going on, like what is worth focusing on and how do we conceptualize it rightly?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right in a sense that it's a real challenge because particularly in the world in which we live today, there's so much going on. There's always so much going on, but now we know about it instantaneously, constantly. If you live on Twitter, as I sometimes do, you're constantly bombarded with new information, new data, new news items, and you have to figure out what is essential and what is not, what is worth pursuing and what is not, what is junk and what is not. That's a big part of the day is figuring out what is true. Just basic, you know, detective work of what is true, because there's so much fake, as everybody knows, there's so much fake news out there and very difficult to find reliable sources, I think, on, doesn't matter what side you're on a particular issue. You know, if we all think and Ayn Rand taught us that ideas shape history, ideas shape the culture, then what really I look for are the issues that reflect what I see as the dominant or the up and coming ideas that are influencing the culture. What are the things that are idea laden, that in a sense are reflecting of the different ideologies, the different philosophies that we all know, I think, dominate the culture. And some stories just pop out that obvious, right? They're existentially major and they're reflective of ideas. 9/11 and the response to 9/11. And really, if I think about my career as a cultural commentator, 9/11 shapes it all, because it was that event was the first event where I came into my own in terms of having a voice and, you know, sharing that voice with a lot of the intellectuals at the Institute, particularly Ankar, who influenced that, greatly. But, you know, me being at the forefront of expressing those views. So 9/11 really shaped that. And 9/11 obviously was an existential. Everybody knew it was the central story. But then I think what was unique about Objectivism is we immediately went to, why did this happen? And why are we responding the way that we're responding? Immediately went to, what are the ideas that drove people to run airplanes into buildings? And then what are the ideas that drove, George Bush to invite, Muslim imams to the White House a month later to celebrate Ramadan. That is what is going on here. And it's that always looking for what are the philosophical drivers and what are the things that are going on in the world that are driven by ideas. The other thing I'd say, you know, we were talking about the show I did recently on the chip industry, which is one of my favorite shows. I hope people go listen to it because I think I learned a lot preparing for it, a lot of stuff I never knew before. I came up with some new thoughts about foreign policy that I didn't have before. True or not, they're at least the new, and you know they should be debated. But I thought it was an interesting show. But for example, there, I think of technology, Silicon Valley, chips, all of that as the remnant of the good in our civilization. It's the remnant of the Enlightenment. And if you think, and I think about the world constantly as this battle between Enlightenment and anti-Enlightenment and pre-Enlightenment. And that's the battle going on. And, so I'm always want to support the Enlightenment side, even when that side is not as good as it could be and should be. But I want to support the Enlightenment side because that's the fundamental battle. It's Enlightenment versus anti-Enlightenment. And we know the consequences of Enlightenment. We're living them in terms of wealth and success. And we know the consequences of anti-Enlightenment because we know history. And then you look at the ideological picture out there. You look at existential events from that perspective. I think it kind of the things that are important jump out because of that.
Yeah, thank you. That division, I mean, the Enlightenment, anti-Enlightenment, strikes me as really important. And what I notice people do, I mean, you've commented on the show about people jumping to dichotomies and wanting to dichotomize everything and not, you know, seeing there are more than two options. At the most fundamental level, there are always going to be two options. But what I find rare is that the things that are conceived as the two options in the culture are the right two, and that they map to what I think are the most fundamental ones. And what really strikes me about Rand's work is the way she kind of cuts through to what really is the essential issue, or at least challenges you to think that what seems to be what's presented as the divide might not be. And I think one of the reasons why I love your program so much is that you're the person in the world today who I think is the most doing that, who's noticing the, you know, it's not right versus left. It's not this versus that. It's not where you might think it is. So how do you I mean, is there anything to say about avoiding being sucked into the false dichotomies and finding where the real dichotomy is?
Yes, I mean, I think that's a big challenge, and it's a big challenge in the world out there. And again, it's what everybody wants you to fall into, and what I think most people do, even most objectivists, sadly. But I think Ayn Rand taught us this. I mean, she and you know, I find it wrong to compare anything I do to Ayn Rand, because if you look at a cultural commentary in the 60s and 70s, it is such a work of genius, and it is so deep, and it's philosophical and psychological. And every time I read it, it's like, oh my God, I learned something new. Even if I read an essay 20 times, I learned something new from reading it again, because of just the way she has a unique way of looking at the world and finding those essentials and disentangling things that look like a mess, but then showing you a perspective on them that you would have never imagined. And here I think, because she was a novelist, she has this psychological dimension that is so unique. And I think I don't have it. I think it's very rare to find somebody who has that dimension on top of everything else. So she can say things about the motivation of people that I find very difficult to say. But yes, I think Ayn Rand taught us, and Leonard Peikoff, they both taught us how to that it isn't the conventional way of looking at the world is wrong, that the conventional way, even, you know, even though and that you always have to look at the world fresh, and you always have to think about things in terms of fundamentals. And, you know, again, I have to give credit to a lot of the intellectuals, because I'm kind of the spokesman, but there's a, in a sense, the spokesman, because I don't really speak for them. But there's a lot of people like you and like Ankar and like Tara, who's here in Texas, and others who are doing the philosophical work behind that I then latch on and take the principles and apply them. And I, you know, I spent a lot of time with Ankar. So over the years when I was at the Institute, and I learned a lot from him. And I think he is very good at catching a lot of these false dichotomies and false options. And he's taught me to do that. But yes, I mean, I think it all goes down to looking at what is the fundamental behind what is going on. So, you know, the traditional left versus right, right? So Democrats, Republicans. Once you understand, once you dig a little bit into what they're actually advocating, once you dig it a little bit into what are they, even just a level of policy, what their actual policy prescriptions are, once you dig into a little bit of that, then you see collectivism on both sides. And we know collectivism is opposed to what we are. So if they're both collectivist, then are they really opposed to one another? They are in some dimension. It's not, I don't think they're the same. They obviously have, collectivism is not one thing. It's a variety of different applications of collectivism. But the contrast is not each other. The contrast is what we are, and that's individualism. So the real, political spectrum, the proper political spectrum is individualism versus collectivism. And then maybe the collectivism forks into five different types of collectivism. But it's basic, and some of them are associated with the right and some of them are associated with the left, but they're all collectivism and they're distinctly different from one another, but they're not individualism. Clearly they're not individualism. So once you can see behind what's going on, once you understand it, its ideas and its fundamental ideas, I think it's much easier to untangle these kind of issues.
And you can come to particular issues, particular debates, whatever's going on in the news, with your diagnosis in hand of what the essences of the factions are. So you can, have indications of where you'll expect them to go. I want to ask one more sort of question to start off, and then I want to open up to if anyone in the room or anyone online wants to ask questions. I know people might be asking on Yaron's super chat or on our page, and we have a microphone here for anyone who wants to. The topic is generally the intellectual landscape today, how to think about current events, and particularly how to do so from an objectivist perspective. The question I want to ask is, why think about the news? Why think about current events? Why think about the current cultural issues? You might think, okay, I've got it. It's collectivism all over the place. A pox on everyone's houses. I don't need to follow this stuff. And of course, not everyone needs to follow it in the same amount of depth. But is it enough just to reject everything? Why is there a real value to following the trends, following the news, having some people on that beat, and all of us maybe having some resources for it, knowing what's going on in the world, if the major factions in the culture wars are both bad or wrong, can't we just accept that and write it all off and, focus on other aspects of our careers or our personal lives?
So first, I have to admit that I definitely have the tendency to think that way. To hell with them. Life is too interesting and too much fun, and there's too much going on, and there's too much things I'd love to do other than that. And that's weird because the amount of cultural commentary and the much of culture I actually do. But I remember as a young objectivist here in Austin, years and years ago, saying publicly in a forum, saying, forget about the news, live your life. Just focus on living your life. First of all, it's the best way to change the world in a sense, because you'll be a model for other people. And secondly, you've only got one life, and why bother with all this really bad stuff that is constantly going on? And it's so much negativity. It's going to have an impact on your sense of life. It's hard not for it not to have an impact on. So I am tempted by that view. And I think any egoist would be. I think if you're really selfish, then your initial tendency should be, I don't care. I just want to live my life. I've got a career. I want to find somebody to love. I want to have a family or whatever it is. That's plenty. What do I need to worry about all this stuff? But of course, there are a few problems with that. One is that you might want to ignore politics, but politics doesn't want to ignore you. That is that the world out there, the culture, and the world out there is in your life, whether you want it or not, whether you identify directly it or not, but they are imposing their force directly or indirectly on you in every aspect of your life, really every aspect of your life, whether it's through the culture. And we live, this is one of the things I don't think we talk about enough, but we live in a pretty bleak culture. I don't think we know that because we don't know what the alternative is. Right? Rand used to talk about the pre-World War and the post-World War culture and how if you didn't experience pre-World War I, if you didn't experience 19th century culture, you have no clue. And she was I don't think there's an accident. She was born in 1905. And so many geniuses were born in the late 19th century, early 20th century. Geniuses that we can all that have a profound impact, that the great artists were born back then. There's something in the culture that was so positive, and our culture sucks. A lot of it's the arts, but it's people's sense of life.
She spoke about us having a cultural value deprivation, and
yes,
analogized it to being in a, like a sensory deprivation chamber.
Yes, it's definitely sensory deprivation. If you think about how the streets in Athens were, and they were lined with art, and there were sculptures everywhere and all that. And it's interesting, if you go in UT, with University of Texas here, and there are sculptures, but they're all old. They were all put up decades ago. And there's a beautiful, I think, a magnificent fountain here that nobody looks at because they're not used to looking at art and they're not used to paying attention. But there's a beautiful fountain right here in front of, not far from the building that we're sitting in, that if you look at the figures there, there's some magnificent figures in the fountain. Nobody looks at it. And it was built, the artist, again, was born in, I think, the early part of the century, lived in San Antonio. But it was put up there a long, long time ago. That is the orientation today is not to surround yourself with beauty and to surround yourself with inspiration. It's if anything, they surround yourself with ugliness. That's the kind of quote art that they put around us. But so there's the culture that you want to be involved in, partially because you want to identify the better parts of it so you can embrace those. Partially because you want to change it and you want to have better people around you and you want to have more beauty around you and you want to have you want to live in an environment that is better and more beautiful. And then, of course, there's a politics, which is all intrusive all the time. And is the things going on are terrifying and are heading in a very wrong direction, a very bad direction. No matter who, you know, wins any particular election, in that sense, it doesn't really matter. It might matter to the speed, but the direction doesn't change. And one needs to have an impact then. One needs to understand it. And look, it's also getting to the point where one wants to be involved, one wants to know what's going on in the world, partially because one wants to know where to live. It used to be easy to know where to live, and it's not so much because there are real differences. The real differences between states, the real differences between countries, the real difference between regions or trajectories in terms of the future. You want to try to have an influence to the extent that you can. And you want to be aware because, just as a survival mechanism, because they're out there to get you and you want to be able to protect yourself in some capacity or another. On the other hand, one also has to be very, very careful, and I have to be very careful, even as somebody who does this professionally, not to overdo it. And as people who are not professionals, you shouldn't do a lot of politics and a lot of stuff. I mean, I talk about this a lot on the show. Life's too important to spend too much time worrying about this stuff because we want to have some impact, but the impact is small. To really have an impact, you'd have to spend a lot of your time doing it. And even then, it's very uncertain. And there are other more interesting things. Life is finite. The world will probably not end in our lifetime, so we might as well live it to the fullest all the way to the end. And if you've completely let the state of the world, particularly the state of politics, dominate you, you'd be very, very depressed. It's very, very depressing. And life's too short for that. There are too many good things in the world, and it's really crucial and important to focus on those as well, to focus on those as a primary and to let, and, you know, I think this is what people value in my show, to a large extent, is that I can give them a quick snapshot of what's going on. They don't have to, you know, spend a huge amount of time studying themselves. To the extent that they trust me, they can get the key points and live their life. So there's the division of labor, which I think is really, really important. But people, I find so many people obsessing about politics, which again, I even have to protect myself from, because if I spent all my time doing this, I'd be depressed. It is really, it's depressing. So, this is why I do, you know, I talk about surrounding yourself with beauty and focusing on your own life and things like that, because I think it's really, really crucial that you not obsess about these things.
I have a few thoughts just like to add about what I see as the value of this kind of work and the place in life of it. We are affected by the culture, one way or another. And when people try to isolate themselves too much from thinking about what's going on, they're still affected by it. Their taxes go up, crime goes one way or another in the country, the political landscape changes, whatever happens. And they're affected by it. They tend to feel resentment about it, and rightfully so, but they often don't know where or how to direct it. they feel a little bit confused and powerless about it. I think it's important to living your life into functioning to have a sense of where you are and what's happening. And you have to have that in kind of essentialized terms, not, you know, every little detail. This is the mayor and that's the third congressman and this guy just won this election or whatever. But like, what politically, what culturally kind of world are you in? And to have it in a way that updates over time. Mm-hmm. What's changing? What happenings are big deals versus small deals? How do they affect the total? Is there something you can do now with your vote in this election? Is this one, you know, where the candidates are so similar, it doesn't make any difference? Or is this one that matters? And you're never going to get maybe the ideal candidate, but maybe one of them is enough better that it's worth going out to vote or encouraging them. To not feel hopeless and senseless and confused and bewildered by the world, you have to have a sense of, at least at the high headline levels, what's happening, what kind of a society you're in, what you can do about it, how it impacts your other values, and to have it conceptualized from values that are true and make sense. And that's hard to find. And it's hard to find in a world where the dominant values and dominant ideas are irrational, incoherent, wrong. And so I think it's important for holders of radical values, holders of true values, holders of true ideas, and objectivists in particular, to be thinking about these things, to have a good source of news and analysis from that perspective. I think that's why it was so important to Rand herself to do this kind of work. And it's why it's important to me that it's going on now, and your show is important to me. I also think one other thing, that for people who are philosophers in particular, which is only a small subset of the group, there's a way in which you can get to the ideas can become floating abstractions if you're not applying them to the world around you. And I remember, I don't know if you'll remember this interaction, but years and years ago when I was working on doing my graduate work, writing on very esoteric issues in Plato and Aristotle about epistemology, I would occasionally pop onto HBL, the Harry Binswanger email list run by a friend of ours, Harry, and I was in a thread arguing about something about Iraq policy, why we'd already lost the war. And you sent me an email saying, like, it's good to see you philosophers, you know, dealing with these current events from time to time. But I think because of the issue of, like, it's not all detached and in the forms, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's that is true of the philosophers. But if for everybody, it's true, because it's so hard. It's important for people to take the objectivism and to see it in the world and to see also the negative predictions that it makes. Apply it's important to see that evil is not efficacious, and you get that when you watch the world. You get a lot of it because there's a lot of evil and a lot of non-efficacious stuff going on. And it's good to see when people are rational and when something is done well that it's successful. And for that, I think it's good for non-philosophers, non-intellectuals, to read some history, to know what's going on in the world. So if you live an integrated life, which is at the end of the day, what a flourishing life requires is that you're really integrated. Your ideas are integrated with the way you live, and your knowledge is constantly growing, and it helps you integrate further your ideas. Then you can't take a part of the world and say, I'm not going to look over there. Mm-hmm. Because then you're negating integration. So even if it's painful to look, you've got to look. And then the question is, how long do I look and how deep do I go and so on? That, you know, that's an evaluation we each have to make, but that's the, I think what people get out of the show again is of somebody like me is I make it a little easier for them to look over there when they don't want to look. But you have to integrate all the knowledge that's going on, everything that's going on, into everything in your life. In the end, it's all connected. And I think one of my strengths has always been, the ability to integrate. So going back to, How do you sift through the news? It's to see connections between stories and to see that it's not, okay, this is going on over here and that's going on over here, and it completely two different stories, but to see that it's all part of a particular trend or part of a particular movement, to see in terms of the world in which we live in, the rise of the alt-right connected to identity politics, right, of the left, right? To see the two that are not just two phenomena, but they're two phenomena of the same thing. And one is breeding off of each other and one is reinforcing the other. To see the 9/11 and the Christian nature of the Bush and the people surrounding Bush and the Christian morality, to see connection between all that. That I think is the advantage we as objectivists have in approaching these things, is we know it's all connected. That they're not disparate, separate things.
Maybe one integration to then seeing the positive to this that I can bring out. And then let's, if anybody again from the room wants to talk or raise an issue, ask questions.
We do have a few.
Please come to the mic and then we'll go to the
Mainly
super chat.
For you, because they're used to asking me questions.
All right. Well, we can riff on them together. But there's a scene in Atlas Shrugged that's really significant to me that I think about sometimes when I'm down and call other people's attention to. Dagny Taggart's at one of her lowest ebbs. Her project, on the rail line that she's proudest of, has finally been totally destroyed. She's breaking down, and Francisco D'Anconia shows up and takes her out for a drink. And she, I forget exactly how he puts it, but she's kind of feeling as though there's no good in the world, as though nothing comes to anything, as though the people, as though the world is made up of the kind of people who are in the meeting that she was just at, mm-hmm. people who can't hold firm convictions about anything, people who just suck or are irrational, and but worse than that, they're just dreary nothings. And he says, like, look at the skyscrapers. Those are there, and they're proof that another kind of man exists, that those people aren't the bottom line on reality. Those people aren't what life's about, that there is something better, that the irrationality that can overwhelm us when we look at the news or current events or are disappointed in people isn't the, you know, the verdict we should reach on the world. And you can see that the other kind of men exist. And she asks, you know, where are they? And he says, and this will become significant to people who understand the plot of the book, when they're wanted, you'll be able to find them. Or when you really want them, you'll be able to find them. But what she's lacking there is a kind of perspective on the world that she'll learn over the course of the novel, the perspective objectivism gives you. But it's work to apply it and to see it. And part of what that perspective does is to see there is real greatness, good, rationality, fantastic things in the world, all over the place. But it's diluted, inundated, mixed up in all kinds of awful junk. And if you don't understand what's awful about the awful junk, what the alternatives to it is, you're not going to be able to see the good that's out there that's being undercut by it. And you're not going to be able to see how to direct your life towards that good. And I think you need that perspective. You need, you know, you need it at the right level of abstraction and not in all the details all the time, but you need to know that it can be done in the details all the time. And so that's part of what I think is about.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And that's part of this, part of, you have to integrate all this into your life, and it has real application. That is, let's say the world out there decides, inspired by Elon Musk, that Apple is an evil company, right? And it's really evil. Then you might abandon, you might decide not to buy Apple products anymore. I mean, that's but to do that, you have to know whether they're really evil, and you have to be engaged, at least to some extent, in that conversation about what it means to be, for a company like that to be evil. Are they? What's going on? So there's no the real decisions in the world. Should I boycott everything made in China? Should I travel to X country? Should I? There are a lot of decisions that these politically relevant issues apply to that affect you. Should I go to work for a particular company? And also that relate to – there are a lot of issues that come out of culture and politics that relate to the good. So, again, I'll pitch my Chip
really good
show. Sure. Because the thing I enjoyed most about the book I read about the Chip was to learn about chips. And when you learn about chips, the semiconductor chips, it's mind-blowing. I mean, I still don't quite get it, right? They fit, I don't know, 100 million transistors into a little silicon. What the hell is 100 million? I mean, can you even contemplate the size of 100 million? How small they would have to be to fit on this little thing? And how do you do that? How do you – I mean, it's mind-boggling to me. I don't know how they do it. I say during the show multiple times, extreme UV light technology. I have no idea what that means, right? But it's cool because it has this application that changes the world that I do know about because I, you know, those chips are going to power all the stuff that I do, the probably powering ability to some extent to communicate with you live via video, and they will certainly power all the stuff in the future. So it's
I could raise the iPhone for you.
So. Yes, there you go. My iPhone's stuck. But it's stunning that people can come up with this stuff. And it's beyond my comprehension in terms of just what they do and how they do it and that it is done. I was describing this mirror that the size of the floor would be the equivalent, I think, of a millimeter if the mirror was the size of Germany. I mean that's precision. And people say there's no such thing as perfection, right? I mean, that's perfect. And that's the kind of mirror you have to have in order to do this extreme UV light and in that kind of perfection. So it's to discover that people, even today, with all the ugliness in the world, are creating these beautiful things, these amazing things that do have an impact. And part of what motivates me, and I think part of what should motivate everybody, is I don't want to see that destroyed. I don't want to see that go away. You know, I'd rather live in a mixed world in which we live where there seems at least some beauty being produced, some amazing things being produced, than the alternative, which is nothing, right? So, and so even maintaining the status quo is a big deal. So we know the status quo cannot be maintained. It has to go one way or the other. But ultimately, even if I'll never see, you know, the perfect state, the perfect state of the world, the perfect culture, an objectivist culture, you know, I'd rather fight to see a better culture than I would otherwise, because there's so much good that actually exists in the world.
And also, I mean, people are really down on the present world, pining for some ideal that hasn't ever been. And when do they wish they had been born? It's not like, you know, our birthright is a perfect society and you got screwed up because you were born this year rather than, you know, 10 years ago when everything would have been ideal. There was no 10 years ago when everything was ideal. Everything's always been the bad. The default is irrationality, primitiveness, savagery. Every step towards a better society is a real achievement. We're not owed it. It was achieved by people who came before us, and we have to do our best to improve it, keep it going. Yep. To really value something is to be, you know, willing to work for it, to appreciate it, and to recognize that you can't expect it to be given to you.
Yes, and part of what frustrates is the number of people out there who are angry because they don't have their perfect objectivist world yet.
Right.
It's like, where was it supposed to come from?
Yeah, if not from...
There is no God.
From you and from us. All right, so we've got, speaking of the world in Silicon Valley we were talking from, a relatively recent transplant from there to here, giving our first question, and then we'll go to Super Chat after
that. Yeah, we got a bunch of Super Chat already.
So Chad, hey.
Yeah, hello. So I guess when you think about, like, I understand why the focus on politics, how it affects everybody. I really like your shows about chips and container ships and all that stuff. I find them really exciting.
Yeah, me too.
Someone I'm particularly inspired by in that area is like Lex Fridman. He seems to like take 3 hours, just dive deep into someone who's really passionate and making some small progress in the world that maybe doesn't warrant a biography, but it kind of gets those stories out, but it's kind of limited to AI and physics, which is great for me, but it's not like, I'm wondering if there's like some missed opportunity within objectivism or some, not missed, but like some opportunity to focus on the things in the world that matter in general to objectivism and getting good ideas out there, but that's spotlighting, I don't know, just like the passion and excitement like Lex does.
I mean, I think there is. I mean, there's a lot to be done. And somebody who would focus their attention on all the good that's being produced, being in entrepreneurs, being in scientists who are doing really exciting and good work that are not objectivists, that are just good people or good people in this particular narrow scope, I think could have real cultural impact out there and could inspire people. I mean, there is a massive value in showing that there are heroes out there in the world, and they are, you know, Colorado in Atlas Shrugged is real. And it's every day. It's right here among us. And we should be celebrating that fact. And I wish somebody would do that.
There is, Gina Gorlin has the Building the Builders podcast she's on, where she's been talking to a lot of founders of companies about their process and what they've done. And you get some of that is in there. But I mean, I agree with you. There could be more. We need a part of it is someone. There's a kind of work in finding the right people, right, and attracting them to be interviewed and so forth.
And knowing how to do it. I mean, what's amazing about Lex, and I'm a fan, so you know, of Lex's, is his ability to take on, I think, difficult, interesting questions, and to do it in a deadpan way. But to be interesting at the same time, right? And to really ask good questions and probing questions and let you speak. That's the other thing, right? I would be wanting jumping in. I would not be good at that, right? Because I'd want to jump in and finish people's sentences. And Lex is very good at letting people speak and letting it all hang out and pushing back sometimes, you know, on certain issues. But yes, a hero show where we just brought out great achievers would be something worthwhile doing. All right, so we've got a few super chats. You can ask. Michael asks if he can ask deep philosophical questions. Given that, because I always say, don't ask me the deep philosophical question. Wait until Greg is on. So yes, you can ask deep philosophical questions if you want to. Greg is here to answer them. So the first one is a $50 question. Thank you, from Caleb Griffin. Caleb says, why is this not working? Oh, all right. The button's not working. All right. Caleb said, sci-fi fan bases have been foxholes for romantics. So it's heartbreaking to see them so crushed over the destruction of the characters and stories they value. Diehard fans are labeled toxic for being upset and are turned into conservative cynics. Okay, so I don't know that I know exactly what you're referring to, but I think I know the phenomena you're relating to, and that is I do think that sci-fi over the last 50 years has probably been the one area in literature where you've seen some romantic stories. Maybe it's not great literature, probably it's not, but at least it's had stories with plots, with heroes, with interesting projections about the future, agree or disagree, with attempts to, and I think it's really been a place where a lot of people seeking the hero in literature, seeking romantic kind of stories, have aggregated. And it is true that I think to a large extent that even there you're seeing naturalism creep in, you're seeing environmentalism, you're seeing a lot of these ideas come in that are undermining the heroism. And it reminds me of that essay in the Romantic Manifesto. What's the name of it? The one about moral treason.
Bootleg? Oh, Philosophy and Moral Treason.
Philosophy and Moral Treason, where she talks about this man that she, Ayn Rand talks about the man that she knows, who when he was a child always sought the heroic. He sought it primarily in comic books and things like that, but he sought the heroic and was always crushed, was always told, oh, life is not like that, don't do that. And the kind of psychological damage that did to him, and I think has done to our culture and has done to our world and done to some extent, I believe it's in all of us. It's really, really hard to root out that kind of attitude, which is in our culture, that cynicism, that skepticism, that putting the hero down. And that is it is tragic, and it is the idea of heroism as being viewed as toxic and unrealistic and not of this world and don't waste your time on it. That has real psychological damage to people, and it's soul crushing. I think that's the right term, soul crushing. So I think that's what you're talking about. Correct me if I'm wrong.
The not of this world point too relates to the original romanticism, and it's as as an artistic movement in literature, and there's a connection to science fiction. That is, romantic stories, why are they called romantic? I mean, what does it have to do with Rome? And they're at least initially set in far gone periods that are remote from actual life. It used to be the past or the Gothic period or whatever, medieval time, think of Ivanhoe or something, to kind of make it somehow other than our everyday, other than our life, because there's the idea that values and grandeur can't be lived out in day-to-day life. The way that we see that nowadays is you put it in space or someplace far off. Part of what Rand was doing in being a romantic realist, and what I think some of the other better romantic writers did, deeper romantic writers, is try not to have them be in such remote from life locations. Hugo is not so remote from life, right, as Scott, for example. Say that this world can be like that. Values and profundity could be ours. And so it's not a surprise that the remnants of it exist in enclaves that are set in ways that remove them from actual life.
Yeah, it's safer for them to do it there. It's, I think, for the writer and for his audience, it's safer to say, okay, well, now we're the heroes. This world, yeah, we know, it's horrible. And you see the same thing, I think, in fantasy. I think you see the same tendency there. Heroes there. You know, again, it might not be great literature, but it certainly is hero worshiping.
But he had something that I didn't quite follow about the toxicity and the fan base, and the fan base is disappointed about something and it drives their politics. And I suspect he's talking about something specific in some franchise that neither of us follow.
I don't know, but yeah. What I don't understand is the conservative cynics. They turn into conservative cynics. Why conservative? Why not others? But they turn into cynics. There's no question about that. And I understand what the toxic is, because their values are being crushed. Their values are being put down, and that turns them into this cynics, which is sad. All right, Bree asks, the start button doesn't work. Okay. It seems as if a small number of sociopaths have dominated all of human history, Hitler, Stalin, etc. Is this true? Would some other person do the same thing? What can we do to expose current and future bad actors? So, I don't think that can't be true. First of all, if that were true, then we wouldn't be here, right? We'd still be in caves or whatever. History's being dominated ultimately by good. Now, too little, too rarely. But what moves the world and what dominates the world is good. Otherwise, again, human life would be short, miserable, pathetic, everything Hobbes thought it was. And I also don't like calling these people sociopaths, because they are guided by – they might be. But why bring in psychology into this? They are guided by particular ideas. These ideas have consequences. They are fulfilling those consequences, and I think it diminishes the role of ideas in what they do by just saying, yeah, there's a bunch of crazy people out there doing horrible things, and somehow they attain power. Somehow they're successful once in a while, or dominantly, as you might say. No, for every Hitler and Stalin, there was an America and a Britain that stood up to them and defeated them, and there were good people on that side, not ideal people. Churchill was not ideal, if you know Churchill, but he was good when it came to World War II. And even FDR was good when it came to World War II, at least once the war was declared. Even though he was terrible before. And so there is good in the world, and good constantly is defeating evil. Notice that good constantly, now too little too late, but it does defeat it. Again, otherwise you wouldn't be here. So it's the way to look at the world is not – unfortunately, we learn history by focusing on all the horrible things that have happened. We don't learn history by focusing on all the great things that happened. But again, put aside politics, for every Hitler and Stalin, there is a Newton, and there's an inventor of the steam engine, and there's an inventor of a chip technology, and 99.999% of all the people who've done great things in the world, you've never heard of. And they've done phenomenal things.
The story of history is not a story of monsters. It's a story of what's good in humankind. Think of it as a giant or a hero, making progress and being stung and set back by gnats. And then occasionally the gnats swarm together, into some giant horror thing. And then he beats it down, but he never gets rid of the gnats. And the question is, why? Where are these gnats coming from? Why can't he, get further? And they're a constant presence, and they're a problem. But what they are is something that's impeding the good. not some are forth. And also, I really second the why sociopath. I mean, if you're not a licensed clinician, forget the license, because license is if you're not a like professional clinician, I think you should in general strike words like sociopath and anything that has like a diagnostic flavor from your vocabulary. It's almost everybody uses these words as like fancy ways of saying jerk. But if it's a fancy way of saying jerk, just say jerk. If it's more than jerk or, you know, something a little spicier than that, it's because you have some specific scientific theory about what's causing this and how it works and functions. Very likely that theory is false, but if it's true, fine. But you've got to know it, and that's the commitment in using that term. And I have no idea if Hitler had this or that diagnosis, or even if the diagnoses are valid. And then in any case, Hitler was not of particular impact historically. There are always bozos like that around, vicious, evil people like that with whatever kinds of personality issues he had. What's significant about Germany in that period is not Hitler, but what it was that there let one of those guys come to power as head of the country, whereas usually those guys aren't running a whole country. Right, it's the other Germans that are the problem, yep. Not Hitler. And what's the cause of the other Germans? If you want to look for your grand evil figures in history, it's the people who are propagating the worst ideas. So Kant, not Hitler. But it's how they came to power. And even about Kant, you want to know, like, why was that influential? Why do these bad ideas, if you know, take Kant as the source, and we're not arguing for that now, but of the source of some of the ideas that led to the modern problems, it's not just he came out of nowhere. Like, why were those ideas influential? You want to think about, like, what is it that people are doing in their thinking that makes them susceptible to the wrong? And what is it, more importantly, that they're doing when they're being right? And how can we double down on that and excise the wrong?
Hi. There's a case right now before the Supreme Court. I'm not sure what stage it's at, about whether Harvard University should be allowed to use race in determining what students they accept to the college.
And you can see Chapel Hill also.
Okay. And I think it's an evil policy, but they're a private university. Shouldn't they be allowed to make their own dumb decisions? They're the ones that are going to suffer for it. But by the same token, an argument that's always made is they're accepting public money also, so the feds get to tell them what to do. So I've got mixed feelings about that case and how it should be decided. I have no idea how they're going to decide. What do you have any thoughts on that, either of you?
And this is the problem of reviewing Supreme Court cases in the context of existing law and a context of an existing legal system. In a free market, in a true free market, you would say, none of my business. I mean, Harvard and them can decide. I think it's an evil practice, but legally there's no issue. But here it's, of course, much more complicated. It's much more complicated by existing law, which says that the universities are not allowed to discriminate. So they're not allowed to discriminate. Now it turns out they are discriminating, but they're discriminating against a group that nobody thought, nobody considered when they passed the anti-discrimination laws. So they were trying to prevent them from discriminating against admitting blacks or, you know, oppressed minorities. They're discriminating against a non-oppressed minority. So how does that fit in? So the question before the Supreme Court is not what is right. The question before the Supreme Court is what is legal, which is a big difference. So, the Supreme Court could decide that they can't do it. They can't discriminate against the Asians. Not on the basis of that is right, that is the ideal, or we'd agree that that's it. But on the basis that if you don't allow them to discriminate against blacks, let's say, well, you can't then allow them to discriminate against Asians. You have to be consistent. You have to apply the law equally.
I mean, my sense is both that the court will and that it should, given where the law is, side against Harvard and UNC, and that it's more clear that they'll side against Harvard than UNC, but probably against both. It was a case brought by a group of Asian students, and we can say that the Asians are the non-discriminated against minority, but historically that's not true. There was a Chinese Exclusion Act in the country, and if you look particularly at the stuff that came out of Harvard, how they're like demoting these Chinese students, it's with these personality tests that are every stereotype you could imagine. that I think is evil, is the policy of racial preferences in admissions evil? There, I think you have to think about, there's something else that I think is weird in shaping our thinking about universities. We think of them all as like public utilities, as though like there is Harvard, our university, which our America's university, which grants entry into our America's elite and so forth. And Harvard is ours. And so it's up to us who they, you know, whatever. And so they should take the best students, or they should take whatever students we think they should take. But like, you don't think that about Meineke, right? Like, you don't think like the best cars are whatever, Ferraris or something, and Meineke doesn't serviceless their mufflers. So they should really not be doing affirmative action for cheap cars. If you think of what education is doing as a service, you would think that different educational institutions would have specializations in different ways of performing that service, maybe for different populations and so forth. And some of them, their view would be like, we want to graduate the people who are going to be able to be the most competent at this the quickest. And so the way to do that is to get the people who are the best off going in. And that's what we call merit. And that's how we do it. And maybe that's what Harvard's mission is or should be or would be a good mission for them. But if we didn't think of Harvard as ours, we would think, you know, if we thought of it as Harvard's, we think they've got to figure out what hill they want to climb, what project they want to solve, what their mission is. And it's so long as it's a rational mission, it's fine for them to do it. And if part of their mission has to do with helping give shots to people they think didn't have shots because of ancestral problems or whatever, that could be a rational mission. So I think the whole there's something a little bit too collectivist about thinking about what a given school's admissions policy should be, apart from the idea that each school is a separate thing with its own mission. But that's all baked into how we think about schools because the government gives all this money to schools. It's just a lot collectivistic assumed in everything about higher education.
And it's more than that. As soon as you put in discrimination laws and as soon as you make talking about these things difficult because of issues of race or because of issues other issues like that, then you limit the scope of experimentation. You limit the scope. So schools can't imagine what kind of missions they might have under different circumstances because now they have to follow these rules, both from a legal perspective and from a cultural perspective, their expectations about what rules they should follow. And there's no open debate about these things. Okay, you know, blacks tend to be poorer in our world, so we're going to accept more blacks because part of our mission is to help the poor parts of society, whatever, right? I don't know. But that you can't, that is not something they can even discuss and debate because there's so many taboos around these issues around discrimination. And it, I think a lot of it comes from the Civil Rights Act and the way it was interpreted later on, affirmative action and the whole cultural interpretation of that phenomenon.
And we're planning to do some, or I am anyway, some programming on that act next year and the year to come. It's Ayn Rand wrote her famous article on racism in 1963, so we're coming up on the anniversary of that, and we're going to have some programming connected to it in the spring. I'm not sure just what exactly. Do one of the super chats.
Okay, we've got like five more. Let's see.
And then I was going to call on someone, but she's coming up on her own accord. So,
oh, there she is.
No, not. Well, not there are two people coming.
Oh, okay, cool. Okay, how do you answer? How do you answer quantum scientists like Feynman, who claim that they have proved nothing is certain? Is this a case of a specialist improperly applying broad knowledge?
Well, maybe, but I mean, to prove something is to have established it as certain. Yes, so I don't even know.
It's a
contradiction in terms. But I don't know that Feynman said that. So the things I've seen or read by him have been often intelligent, witty, and that is when they deal with matters I can understand, and then sometimes about matters I don't understand. So that's all I have to say about that. So I was going to say we should talk a little bit about China because I had a really interesting message from someone asking for some commentary on it, and here she is.
Yeah, so I was a little hesitant to ask the question because there are just so many things going on right now about China, and I just struggle to frame a question well. So Basically, what's happening is that there are a lot of protests about CCP and about Xi Jinping happening around the world and also inside China, which is very surprising. A lot of young people are sort of mobilizing, doing these protests in universities in China. And my question is, surprisingly, I did not feel hope after seeing all these protests. I don't think it's a fight that has a chance to succeed. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm willing to be proven wrong. But I think the majority of Chinese people are only disagreeing with the degree of the lockdown instead of we don't want lockdown at all. It's more like, oh, we want to be let out of our house. But the residential area, you know, we understand if for public safety, we can't go out. So I see these people, young people who are actually brave and actually idealistic, going out, risking their lives for a fight that I'm not sure if it's worth fighting for. And I just want to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to separate whether it's worth fighting for and whether they'll be successful. They're not the same thing. Because they might fail and it might still be worth fighting for. Because there's always a potential of success. So I don't know, because I mean, I haven't been to China in 3 years, 4 years, and things were changing significantly. China was becoming a lot more authoritarian the last time I was there. So things have gotten worse, I think, and COVID has brought out the worst in the authoritarian regime. I've also been surprised at the extent of the demonstrations and pleasantly surprised, excited by it. Although I like you, I don't think this will be it, but I still think it's a good thing and I think it's a good sign. There were demonstrations at 50 different universities over the weekend.
I think there were 80 now.
It's up to 80 now. Yeah, yeah. And on Monday, there weren't any demonstrations in Shanghai and Beijing because the police were out in force, but there were lots of demonstrations in other cities around China. So this is major. And I said, I think on my show, if it goes in a positive direction, this will be the biggest story of the decade, the century. I don't know. I mean, it'll be huge, right? Because China is such an important country today. And what happens there is so important to all of our lives. And I think it's huge and important. I think in authoritarian regimes, people generally, most people learn to live with their authoritarianism. They have a certain rhythm in their lives. They don't break out of the rhythm. It's not like they're eager to say something that the regime is going to shut them down. They separate themselves from it, and they support the lockdowns a little bit. They support Xi because everybody else supports Xi and so on, but they're not engaged. They're just living their lives. But then what happens and can happen is that people who care, people go out and demonstrate, suddenly make a big deal out of something. And suddenly it wakes people up. And they say, wait a minute. There is something wrong here. I should, you know, I like the white papers that they're holding up, right? They're holding up these blank sheets of paper. We have no free speech. We can't write anything down, which I think is powerful. I think this might wake up the new middle class in China. So there's a new middle class in China that is first generation, has made money, is living a life where they have choices, right? Previous generations had no choices. And maybe they're starting to think maybe we should have even more choices, like politics and other things. And maybe this will wake them up. Maybe it'll encourage them to do more. Maybe not, but maybe. It's worth a shot. I mean, look what's happening in Iran, right? There's a certain parallel there. Some girls went out and they started protesting because this girl was killed because of the hijab. Hijab's been in Iran mandated since 1979, right? I'm sure there have been women who have been upset about that. And I'm sure there are lots of people who have been upset about it. But now suddenly it's snowballing. It's not just the hijab. They're shooting people who are demonstrating. That's wrong. So we'll protest that. And then something else happened, and that's wrong. We'll protest, and it just snowballs. Now, I don't know if Iran will make a difference, but it's a step in that direction. So China's looking now. Xi is looking now, and he's seeing demonstrations all over China. I think he's a little worried. I think he could crush these demonstrations. That would cost him a lot within China, because I think people, Tiananmen Square, one of the things that happened in Tiananmen Square when all those kids were murdered is we didn't have video of it. We didn't see it happen. We didn't see it in the world, and the Chinese people didn't see it. They know people who disappeared, but it wasn't visceral. This will be broadcast. If he shuts these people down, if he starts shooting in the streets, this will be broadcast, and that'll wake more people up. So I don't know that I'm as negative. Now, this might not result in it, but this might be a first step where people start saying within China, huh, there is a significant number opposed. And I'm happy that they're not saying anti-lockdowns. They're saying we have no free speech. They're saying we want Xi gone. They're saying we want the Communist Party gone. Wow. That's a big step in China to say stuff like that. Even in Tiananmen Square. Tiananmen Square started out as we want a little bit more economic liberty. We want a little bit more – they want for democracy or certainly not individual rights or anything like that. But as that grew, they became more bold, and that's what got – so this is an inevitable step towards the collapse of dictatorship. Now, is it going to lead to collapse? I don't know. But you're not going to have collapse unless this happens.
And
so you should – this should fill you with admiration for them for doing it and fill you with some level of hope that that even in China – where we thought everybody was kind of sleepy and accepting, they're coming out into the streets and they're demonstrating. And with the surveillance state now, the government knows who's demonstrating. They're going after them. So this takes a lot of courage to go out into the street right now in China. Good for them.
And the two further thoughts. I mean, either it's suppressed in a really brutal way, which is then going to have effects on waking more people up, or it's not. And if it's not, that pushes the envelope of what's acceptable to say, or what people think it's acceptable to say. I think so. Either way, I think there's a loss here once it's reached this level for the regime. The other thing is maybe behind the question or some of the pessimism is a premise about what it's like to have a goal or a cause. That is, like, there's some fundamental idea that you're fighting for, and that's the idea you're fighting for, and you're either fighting for the right one or the wrong one. You're either fighting for freedom or just a little less lockdowns, but there should be some lockdowns, but not these. But I actually don't think people's goals are as determinate as that. People are aggrieved. Something's wrong in their lives. They don't quite know what it is, and they're looking for a way to conceptualize it. I think – and they're feeling something has to be done about it. I think that's how all kind of resistance movements or change movements start. It's not that they have in their back pocket a philosophy how things should be and a conceptualization about precisely what's wrong. They have something's wrong here, something's off here. I can say some of what it is, but I'm not always able to articulate it. And there are different competing articulations of it. And in the process of the movement forming – it never forms with a fully articulate thing already there in the back pocket. The articulation comes about as the movement develops and matures. And so I don't think we know yet what this is going to be about. The fact that it's already connected to free speech and so forth is a very promising sign. If it was like they came out with a manifesto of we should have exactly New Zealand's policy rather than China's, like that would be pretty depressing. But I don't think that's what it is. It's people like resenting what's been done to them and resenting the people who are doing it and then trying to understand that and look for an alternative. And I think most movements, for good or bad, start that way. And then there's an issue of then how do people conceptualize it? How do they come to understand it? And that's the point at which an influx of really good ideas is needed. And I mean, one thing that would be great to be happening in the world today is infusions of the best ideas on this into people who are influential in this movement in China. And this is something for, you know, people with connections and Chinese speakers to do, I know.
Well, maybe they're reading Atlas Shrugged, but, yeah. You know, which is available. But, it just occurred to me. This is one of the best times right now in the last decade. Like all the trends 6 months ago or 9 months ago, whatever, were towards authoritarianism. Every trend in the world suggested that authoritarianism was in the vogue. American conservatives wanted nationalism and they wanted authoritarianism. In Europe, authoritarian political parties were winning. Putin looked like a genius. Xi looked like a genius. Iran was standing up to the United States and doing whatever the hell it wanted. The authoritarians in the world were and the model was Orban in Hungary or whatever. And 6 months or 9 months or whatever gone by, Putin's like the biggest idiot in the world right now, complete and utter failure. The Iranian regime, their massive protests in the street, they have no idea what to do with it. The same reason I think the Chinese don't, because if they go out in the streets, really start shooting everybody, which they've done in the past, this time there'll be video of it. This time it might result in something bigger. And now we've got demonstration. I'm super excited right now because like the authoritarians are folding. I can tell the wind going out of all the Western authoritarians because their role models are all collapsing. And everybody's making fun of Donald Trump. What could be better? I mean, life is good. So, but yeah, there seems to be a shift because we're seeing the impotence of authoritarians. And just 9 months ago, everybody in the cultural world out there was saying, No, they get stuff done, right? The old kind of phrase. And now we're seeing how weak they are. And I think this the fact that it's around COVID, zero COVID policy is really good because this is like a top-down government policy and it's completely screwed up and it's completely messed up and look at the consequences. And they didn't want Western vaccines. They shunned Western vaccines. Okay, the consequences even there. So it's
And it's also a policy on which the rest of the world
relied.
Aped anemically authoritarian China.
Yeah.
I mean, the policies that the rest of the world adapted on COVID were like light versions of Beijing's policies, which was a disgrace and a horror. And
and it's ironic and amazing that the rebellion against these policies is in China, not here, right? We never went out and demonstrated against lockdowns. But they are, which I think is such a perfect closing of a circle. And, I don't know. I see it all in the positive, not to say that it's going to result in the fall of Xi. I hope it does. Or the fall of the Communist Party in China. But that the Chinese have this spirit in them right now says a lot. And even if it's just young people, okay, young people are going to be around for a while. And hopefully they can hold on to that. I mean, the 89 generation, the Tiananmen Square generation was crushed by the brutality of what they saw. And they went in a sense, it depressed them and they just put their head down and went on living. Let's hope that doesn't happen to this generation of protesters.
While we're on China and while you didn't get a news wrap up today, any quick thoughts on the other big news out of China today that Zhang's passed? I can never pronounce Chinese names.
Yeah, I can't remember his name. Yeah, I mean,
Tiananmen and opening. So.
What's that?
That is the leader that did the crush the Tiananmen rioters, and
he's the leader that did,
and also who opened up a lot of.
Yeah, so that's not how they led the story. They led the story with his opening up. Well, the person who really made the decision to crush the demonstration in Tiananmen Square was Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping was the unofficial leader of China throughout that period. He was in the background always. He was the guy who made the decisions. There were premiers, there were other people who filled the top spots, but it was clear throughout that period that Deng Xiaoping was the guy in charge and running things. He termed himself out because he's the guy who really instituted this term limit kind of system that Xi has undone. So I think Deng, in my book, gets the blame for Tiananmen Square, and it fits Deng. I mean, Deng Xiaoping was Mao's right-hand man for much of the period Mao was ruler, but then he was penalized by in the Cultural Revolution. He was sent out, and his family. I think his son died, or his son fell and got. I can't remember the exact story, but bad things happened. But what happened in the period of the 80s and 90s, and there's no question about this, is a massive opening up of China. And that has benefited Chinese lives enormously. It obviously wasn't done consistently. And obviously there was Tiananmen Square, which is such a horrific evil. But in total, for the people who weren't crushed in 89, it is one of the most amazing stories in human history. I mean, in terms of the number of people coming out of poverty, the creation of the maybe the largest middle class in the world, the prosperity, the wealth, the everything that's happened over there. And again, you know, you see this interaction between evil that is clearly there, but the good, you know, succeeding. And all the Chinese people needed was a little bit of freedom, just a little bit, get a pseudo property rights. I'm a huge fan of China because of this, a little bit of freedom. How much they did with that, how much they achieved, how much success they, how much wealth and prosperity they generated for themselves. And
how quickly.
And how quickly is just stunning and amazing. Now, a lot of that has to do with investment from overseas and the fact that they could benefit from the capital that came from overseas, the knowledge, the funding, and the equipment that came from overseas. But still, it's just a stunning story. And it's a story that I think we don't even yet have a full understanding of. There's still people out there who think our trade with China had a negative impact in the United States, which is complete nonsense. But this full story of what happened over the last since 1979 to today, as a result of globalization, has not really been told yet, and will one day. And China's a big, big part of that. I don't know. You know, what do you say about somebody who was responsible for the deaths of many people? Good riddance. On the other hand, they did open up China, which was a good thing. So, I mean, this is the complication in history. They're not just sociopaths. That would be too simple to just call them sociopaths. They are motivated by complex motivations that generate these horrifically mixed results. And
this goes to our one of the themes that we started with, that you can't just go through history and put white hats and black hats on people who are the heroes and who are the villains. Some people are consistent heroes and some people are consistent villains. And black and white really does matter. You have to resolve shades of gray into black and white. But it's not by finding the particular people or groups or agencies all the time. It's what ideas or principles mm-hmm. were there, and understanding the complicated ways in which those are either indifferent people or influencing their actions, if not through their own character, through the fact that they have to, deal with other people in the world or other forces in the world that are operating on them.
And again, it's interesting. Is why do we have these people who can do both good and evil at the same time? And I think this China with Deng at least, because I've read about Deng, so I know a little bit about him. Deng is a great example of what happens when you're a pragmatist. So what happened to Deng is he gave up on the principles of communism once he saw how backward China was relative to the rest of the world. So his principles are – his support of communism was grounded in some bizarre belief that communism really would be an achievement. And then when he went to Japan and he went elsewhere and he saw how primitive China was relative to the rest of the world, he came back and said, well, this can't be right, right? So – it's not that he adopted good principles then. Mm-hmm. He kept his collectivistic principles, but he became a pragmatist about them. I mean, he kept his collectivistic kind of worldview, but he became a pragmatist in terms of how to apply them. There was no long-term thinking. There were no principles. We'll try this. We'll try that. You know, a few people die here. Okay, that didn't work. We'll try something else. He didn't care about individuals. He cared about China being successful. And he opened up a little bit, and that was huge success from the perspective of China being successful. So he opened up more. But then when that was threatened by Tiananmen Square, he said, okay, so we'll kill a few thousand people, and then we'll get back to opening up because that is good for China. But this shows kind of how you know, when you've got a bad goal, whether you're guided by principles or by pragmatism, doesn't matter. Bad things are going to happen. But at least when you're not consistently bad on principles, some good things can happen as well.
So. Yeah. Part of what you have to think about when you're judging pragmatists is, I mean, pragmatism is about compromising and tearing down principles. And are you tearing down good principles or bad principles? If you're a pragmatic communist, what you're saying is, I'm not taking my communism too seriously. If you're a pragmatic president of America, what you're saying is, I'm not taking rights too seriously.
Yep. All right.
On the super chat? Yeah.
Do we have a cap?
We can at least go till 3, and we can go a bit after.
Okay, well, let's try to finish the super chats. Let me go back to Andy's, because he did put some money on this question about Feynman, not so much about Feynman. But do you have an answer to the quantum mechanic type interpretation of there is no such thing as certainty in the world because look, quantum mechanics?
It's that's not what any kind of physics, that's not a kind of things physics can show. And it's not the sort of thing any kind of physics I know about does show. It's just, you can, a lot of what passes for popular analysis of science, yes, is just regular stuff people have always thought put in scientific language, wrongly so. So it's like what we said about sociopath earlier. It just means jerk the way most people use it. And they should just use the word jerk. They don't freaking know what it means. And likewise, I can't be sure of anything. And then something, something, quantum, quantum, you say after it. It's not, that's not the kind of thing the physics says. If you want to know what quantum physics says, read a book that's actually about quantum physics, not a kind of, Deepak Chopra-esque, think of it. And the actual things that, that physicists say that are anti-certainty, that have some teeth to them, come from people like Popper and so forth, and aren't based on, and ultimately from Hume, and aren't based on anything specific to quantum physics. So, I mean, there are a bunch of things that are startling and strange about the quantum world, things that, you know, knowing one thing puts you in a situation where you can't know something else. There are levels of details and specificity of things you can't know. I don't know or understand very much of that, but that's not the kind of thing that could possibly say you can't be certain of anything. Resources on quantum mechanics, I hesitate to give because I know so little about the field, but there's a book by Travis Norson, something Foundations of Quantum Mechanics or something like that, that attempts to teach quantum mechanics from an evidence-based, this experiment was observed, here's, you know, the mathematical formulas of it, here are the questions that it raises and that leave it open, and I can only get a little bit into it before the math gets too heavy weather for me. But if people want a kind of, you know, interesting kind of sense of what does this show and what doesn't it, that might be a place to look. I know I've learned a lot from conversations with him over the years about it. If you have a particular thing, though, that you're interested in, a particular video or something, you know, send it to one of us. We did that thing a few years ago on, what's the name of that guy who thinks there's no reality because some beetle sleeps with a Coke bottle?
Yeah, I just saw him again because he's very, very popular.
Seymour Hoffman.
Hoffman from University of California, Irvine. Yeah, I mean, I'd say one thing about quantum mechanics. One thing that I find just interesting, there's a lot of disagreement among scientists about what it means. So they all agree about the phenomena. They agree about the equations. They agree that it works. We see quantum phenomena in computers and chip making. They have to deal with quantum phenomena. There's no question quantum phenomena exist. What it means, how you interpret it, how you turn that into English, right, in for us to understand it, there's vast disagreements among scientists. So to take one interpretation, which vaguely says we can't be certain about anything, is just unscientific because you haven't really researched it. But you haven't really looked at it. And I'm not even sure anybody actually says that.
Yeah,
although arguably some of the physicists did say that, but it's not important that they said it. There's,
when they say it, they're not talking about quantum mechanics.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't be certain of anything. You can't be certain that, you know, twice six is 12. Is that quantum mechanics? It's not, like, if you make that interpretation, it's some philosophical leap vaguely inspired by something you're misunderstanding about some science.
Yep. All right, we've just got added questions. Okay, to Greg, are you aware of any objectivist philosophers who have taken on the concept of gender through objectivist epistemology?
No, I mean, Ben and maybe Ankar did a podcast where they kind of thought a bit about Kathleen Stock's book. There was then a Clubhouse session where we talked a little about it there, but it was all kind of informal. I'm a little more skeptical of some of what Stock says than they are. I mean, some of us have had informal discussions of it, but no one's really written on it, to my knowledge.
Yeah, I recommend the book, Stock's book, whether you agree with all of it or not. I think it's very thoughtfully written and interesting, and covers the debates. Greg, are we living through an intellectual inquisition of moral authoritarianism? It's talking about equity and social justice and that kind of stuff.
I mean, the Inquisition killed people. And so I think that, you know, it's a little – we should be careful about too quickly likening things to it. There are a lot of very censorious people with bad ideas – some of whom are noisier now than they used to be, They're certainly prominent in universities. They've always been prominent in universities. I think they're worse now than they were 10 or 20 years ago, but not maybe so much worse now as people in the general public tend to imagine. I think the bigger issues now are in corporate HR departments and what kind of influence is there. And I'm not close enough to that world to know. But I think my sense is that we're past the peak of that stuff. I think that stuff peaked about a year or two ago. It's still going to be around and around with us. It's been around and around with us for a long time. But I think we're at the peak of this wave. It's already crested. Those of us who are, you know, even a little, have a little bit of time under our belt. What's the idiom there? Who've been around a few times, you know, remember that there was a kind of period of like, you know, things were a lot more PC in the 90s and they got less so in the 2000s. And then, so these things rise and fall. I don't mean that there's not an overall trajectory to them, but I don't think we're cascading to an inquisition anytime soon.
Yeah, I agree with that.
There are things to be concerned about and to fight and push back against, but it's not at the level of inquisition. And I think it's going to recede a little bit, going to get a little better before it gets much worse.
John, thanks for the support. Let's see, we got Simon. Hey, Greg, try and catch you on Clubhouse. Keep up the great rooms. Just wanted to know if objectivism holds that prostitution is immoral and why.
I think
question out of nowhere.
Rand certainly thought it was immoral. I think I do. I'm not sort of on the barricades of fighting against it. It's illegal and it shouldn't be. I've not known any prostitutes or people who patronize them, so it's a little bit kind of floating to me. It seems very hard to imagine a healthy and good reason to avail yourself of that service, or that it can be a healthy career to be in, and that anyone would do it for anything other than desperation. But I've not thought very much about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think it's hard to imagine somebody being able to earn self-esteem in a profession like that. It's hard to imagine them having a healthy relationship with sex, choosing a career like that. Could you imagine somebody in a particular life circumstance where that was their only out? And therefore, they did it. Is that horrific? No, I don't think it is. So I'm not. We're not Christian moral crusaders who are anti-prostitution because it violates some. We just think it's bad for you, right? The immorality here is not towards other people. The immorality is what you're doing with your own life and how it affects you as a human being and how it affects your ability to have a future.
This is what gave me pause about saying, I mean, when people think of prostitution as immoral or bad, there tends to be a focus on the prostitute, the fallen woman. There's a stain on her. She's awful. She's disgusting. And that's, I mean, to me, it's like gross. You want to go to that's the service you want. That's how you want to have sex. Yeah. And then when I think about her, what an awful job. And why would you want to have it? And like, you know, so it's, I would think of it as any other, in the way that I would think about any other destructive, if we're right that it is, service. Someone's, you know, whatever, a heroin dealer or something.
Yeah, and you could, I could imagine circumstances in life where you would do it because you had to, and it was is your way out in some way, and I wouldn't condemn a person for doing that, and certainly it should be legal.
Yeah, it's not discussed at Cosette that's motivating this.
Simon asks, hey, Greg. We just did that. Let's see. Greg, what is your evaluation of Jordan Peterson today compared to when you guys debated him 5 years ago? I think he's gone completely insane since then.
I mean, he was pretty bad back then in lots of ways. One of the things I was sad about that panel is I didn't think we got to most of the differences. I had a lot of things I wanted to say on it, and we just didn't get around to the topics, and we were like – focused on whether a stump in the woods is a chair or a seat if you sit on it, which was fine. But like if we had had 4 hours and we didn't, he said, and I haven't really dug that much into it, a lot of crazy, awful stuff about Russia. I had the sense that the guy is really changed or shifted or gone off the deep end. Then I saw him at a conference a few weeks ago, the academic freedom conference I was at in Stanford. I didn't talk to him one-on-one because there were a bunch of people around him, but I saw him and he seemed to me like the same guy. He actually made some really good points in his talk on it as well as some bad points. And I think he's essentially the same person he was then. I think it's kind of there are good things in our conversation, but I think it's a shame that it didn't get to the heart of what we disagreed about and we couldn't moralize over this agreement. And so it was a little too friendly for that reason.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I do think, though, he seems angrier. Now, maybe not in person, but at least on his videos, he's projecting an angrier vision. He seemed much more benevolent in the past. And now some of his videos, he just looks like an angry prophet. I mean, and he prophesizes. This is what's going to happen to the world. You know, I think in one of the videos I showed, he was predicting the price of oil, right? I mean, why would you do that? I mean, you're nuts. Yeah. I wouldn't do that. And I know more than Jordan Peterson does about prices. So, but he, you know, doing things like that, which is like, it's almost biblical. And he had this almost biblical attitude of the doom and gloom and the world is going to end if this continues. And that I don't remember having as much in the past. I think he got away from being a teacher and now has become more, a prophet. And that is, it's a different tone. I thought he was a very engaging teacher. Whether the content was good or not is a question, but he was very engaging. Particularly, I liked his the videos. If you saw the early videos of him just in the classroom teaching his class, he did a thing on Pinocchio. He did a thing. I mean, they were fascinating, even when you disagreed with him. Today, I find less of what he says fascinating. It's more, he's in the shtick that he has.
Yeah, so I expected that when I saw him, and he was more like the old Jordan Peterson. But again, the old Jordan Peterson was not great. He was a guy who was mostly for bad things with some good things mixed in with them, which is how, interesting, in his delivery of it, thoughtful, just often bad and wrong.
All right, Daniel says, Greg, are you as cautiously optimistic about recent developments as Yaron expressed? P.S., you should do more guest appearances on Yaron's show.
We'll talk about that. Yeah. About the specific, I hadn't thought about it. I had put together China and Iran as two places we were having at the same time, really welcome opposition to longstanding authoritarians, longer standing in Iran. Depending on what you count as your 0 year. I hadn't thought of it as connected to the pushback in the American elections, but I think that is a real connection. It is a cause for optimism. I don't think we're on a straight line trajectory path for the good or bad. History is jagged. There are ups and downs, and you have to zoom out a lot historically, and every little adjustment down seems like the bottom's falling out, and every adjustment up can seem to people like, well, now we have salvation. I don't think, the change between the last 6 months and now is a kind of salvation, but it's a welcome change. It's things are headed a bit up. And what I see it as is there was a sense in which I do think the bottom had fallen out for the world. The world was in a kind of stable state roughly since the fall of communism to 9/11. Then 9/11 messed things up and had us going downhill for a while, but it kind of got into and the financial crisis, but it kind of got into a somewhat stable trajectory. And I think the a bunch of events around the 2015 through recently, of which the Trump presidency was a big part, had the bottom falling out of the things that were sustaining values in the world. I think we're really deteriorating a lot more quickly. And a lot of that damage has been done. I don't think we're going to rebound from it. I think the Republican Party, which was never a good party, it was in the 1840s, but 1860s, but in my lifetime was never a good party, is a orders of magnitude worse than it was before. Therefore much less attractive as an alternative to the Democrats, but it could have kept on going into the subterranean. I think we're seeing signs that the you know, we're reaching a new bottom and we can start to grow up a bit from it rather than that we're falling through the floor. I think the left has been relatively stable. It's got worse and then it's.
Yeah, it's also stabilized in a sense that it's at least somewhat rejecting its crazy left.
And that's part of the thinking that we're past peak woke, so to speak, at least for this iteration.
I think so. I think so as well. And the other thing that I mentioned that I think is relevant is Putin. I do think the failure of Russia and Ukraine is resonating in the world. I don't think it's a real event. And people are trying to see the connection between that and authoritarianism. You're starting to see people talk about that, and that's, I think, important.
And hopefully it'll have the kind of effect on the right that the failure of socialism had on the left. It's not going to turn them to 180, but it's going to make them more.
It's certainly going to slow them down. And if it continues like this, I mean, there's still, I mean, Jordan Peterson is still out there telling us, we have to accommodate Putin because he's so dangerous. But if it continues like this in this trajectory, then I think they'll have to rethink or at least reframe the way they present this vision. Okay, two last questions. Was altruism designed by and for sociopaths? It's a code of ethics when implemented, always propels them to the top and directs resources towards them. Although evil is impotent, it can be clever.
Altruism is designed by and for the worst in us, by and for evasion, by and for anti-effort, not by and for some specific psychological diagnosis that was come up however many decades ago that may or may not be good as a psychological diagnosis, but is not a synonym for evil. Stop using sociopath where you mean wicked, bad, evil jerk. In general, don't use scientific vocabulary for things that aren't special topics within that science. Bad people are not in general sociopaths. They're bad people. Some of them might have whatever specific disorder sociopathy is, which I don't even claim to understand. Maybe it's a valid concept. If it is a valid concept, it's a valid concept for a particular science, not for to be taken over to mean crummy person. And we have this kind of treadmill where, you know, a concept gets introduced in a science, then people take it over to mean some kind of, you know, common parlance thing that there are already perfectly good words for, then the science can't use it anymore because everybody has these other associations. They have to come up with some other term. Just like we don't need that. We have perfectly good words for bad people without taking over diagnostic category terms.
Yeah, and I also don't like the idea of calling them clever. Even if it's true that, altruism was designed for the worst in us, but was used by people in order to attain control over us, which I think it was and has been and still is being used for that purpose. To call them clever is to demean the idea of cleverness. They're not clever. They're miserable, pathetic human beings who are so insecure that they have to control other people.
Of the people who are like that, some of them are shrewder at it than others. And so those people end up, you know,
and shrewd is a much better word because it doesn't have the positive connotation of clever, of smart, of intelligent, of the manipulative and Ellsworth Tuohy. Is Ellsworth Tuohy clever? That's not the word I would use.
I mean, of course, hear clever with these Greek philosophy resonances of it. It's often used as a translation of the word denos, but that doesn't matter. But anyway, there's a word that Plato and Aristotle used to mean smart, but not necessarily good. You're good at figuring out the means to your end, but maybe you've got the worst end, and that clever tends to be the word that's used to translate that. And so in that sense, I guess clever maybe is fine, but it's not for the needs of the clever people. It's for what's bad in people, and then when you're in a situation where the worst is, you know, worst aspects of people are given every advantage, then the people who are shrewder, cleverer, smarter, and evil, you know, tend to do better than the maybe stupider evil people, but what does their doing better at achieving their immediate aims get them? It gets them just more misery. Yep. So now they're dictator rather than a mere mafia boss. And it's a lot worse for you to be a dictator than a mafia boss. Both of them are awful. Better off just, you know, being a mugger or a petty criminal. But all of these are horrible ways to live. And Hitler would have been better off if he was just, you know, some awful artist trying to, you know, starving in his artist garret, than if he, you know, was also a slaughter butcher of a continent.
Yeah, even though he ruled the continent, you know, don't use their standards for what is good. Don't accept their standards of good. It's and the more you study history, the more you realize how pathetic they are. All right, last question. How would you respond to someone – well, maybe not a last question. How would you respond to someone that said objectivism was closer to Hume than Aristotle?
Well, I'd ask them what they meant. I mean, they're – you know, what in particular about Hume – how do they understand Hume and how do they understand Aristotle? And what is it in Hume that they think is closer to objectivism, et cetera, et cetera? And I think that's not true. I think of the two, objectivism's a lot closer to Aristotle, but there are significant points in which it disagrees with Aristotle. There are some commonalities you can find between any two things, and there are some commonalities with Hume. So I think there's a chance that somebody who's thinking that is noticing some interesting points that he's on about something, but missing the essentials. But, you know, or maybe not. So I'd want to know, to make it not just a, you know, where's the meat of this point? What's he noticing about Hume and Aristotle?
All right. Does Greg get any positive feedback from his students or fellow faculty members for his objectivist views?
That's a weird thing to happen. I don't know of anybody who gets feedback under brand name for I couldn't imagine someone like, oh, you're such a Kantian or something, giving feedback to their professor, or a Humean or whatever. I get sometimes positive feedback from people on particular points that I've made or lessons I've taught, from students. Well, I'll give you one, since we talked about China before, one bit of feedback I got from a student that really meant a lot to me. It feels too much like bragging. There was a student back when I was teaching at Rutgers who was from China, and had parents who had very specific expectations of her. Apparently, I got the impression from her that this is how it was in China. I don't know that that's true, but it's been whatever, you know, niche of the culture her family comes from. You send your daughter to get a good education so that she'll be an accountant and she'll marry a man and he'll start a business and she'll keep the books. And this is what her parents sought for her. And she didn't want to be an accountant. She liked literature and philosophy and other things. And she was like talking about different ways to try to get a little bit of this into her accounting life. And she didn't want to she kept on coming and talking to me in office hours, which started to be about the Plato we were reading, but ended up being about all these other things. And at some point I said something like, well, this is your life and you only get one and you have to decide what you want to do with it. And, you know, these are all like points right out of the fountainhead, right? So they're objectivist points, if anything is. Mm-hmm. And, she's gone on to be in film school now. And, she writes occasionally sharing a script or a little short that she's done and talks about that as having had an influence on her. So that's one case of really positive feedback. And there are others, you know, in little ways.
Good. I think that's our super chat.
All right. Then
we'll wrap it up.
I think we've wrapped it up. We're at about time we said we'd finish. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I think this will probably be our last episode, certainly our last in person here for the semester, since the semester's over. Maybe we'll do some over Zoom or something, of Check Your Premises. But the Check Your Premises podcasts have now been uploaded, so you should be able to find them on a podcast catcher and hear some of the conversations we've had in past weeks. Gina and I were having a discussion last week of unconditional love. Ben Bayer and I and Mike Mazza have done things over the past few weeks, and we'll be back with regular programming in the spring semester. You guys should tune in tonight for People Online, or come here to the university if you can for Yaron Brook and Mika Watson talking about Ayn Rand versus C.S. Lewis on the specter of authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And what's coming up on the Yaron Brook show in future days?
I have no idea. Maybe I'll do a show tomorrow morning. I don't know. But certainly over the weekend, we'll do some shows over the weekend.
I'm looking forward to it. I've been really liking the news briefings.
Okay, good, good. So next week, every day, next week, we'll see if I can tolerate that. We'll see if you can tolerate it. And we'll be doing those. And then we'll see. It's a new year soon. I like this time of year. I've talked about this in the past, but I like this time of year. Things seem to slow down in December, the holidays, just I don't know. There's just a thoughtfulness to this time of year. So it's a good time to plan and to think about the future and to think about what changes to make. So I'm going to spend December trying to figure out how to boost the Yaron Brook show, take it to the next level. We'll see.
Thanks, everyone. And good afternoon.
Thank you.
This has been Choose Your Issues, the podcast of the Objectivism Program of the Salem Center, recorded live in the McComb School of Business at the University of Texas, Austin. Opinions expressed herein are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views of the university or any of its component units.